I grew up in the Middle East. Actually, I didn't. I grew up in a place called Potter's Bar, a town to the north of London from which my father commuted daily to work in London. But the Middle East seemed very close. This was the 1950s. I have no recollection of the coronation of the Queen in 1953, but I can recall when the petrol station, a gas station to you, a couple of hundred yards from my home, displayed signs saying petrol was rationed. That would have been in 1956, after British and French troops had seized the Suez Canal. I knew that the Suez Canal was in Egypt, and Egypt was where the pyramids were. I knew all this not because of television. We didn't have one. I knew because my father told me bedtime stories about the Middle East, where he had served as a British soldier during the Second World War from 1940 until 1943 before being repatriated back home to England because of ill health. As a special privilege, I was allowed to look through his photo album of the time. I have it here. As a young boy, I was intrigued by the wooden covers. The painting on the front is captioned, Bethlehem, the Church of the Nativity. On the back is written, Jerusalem. There were some great pictures. There are some great pictures in it. My father floating in the Dead Sea. My father in Jerusalem. Decades before Banana Republic's old ad campaign, my father was wearing a pith helmet. There were also photos of the Wailing Wall and a young woman captioned as being a Jewish refugee. Fishermen in the Sea of Galilee, tarbushed policemen searching suspects in the old city of Jerusalem. Muddy streets in Mirjayun. My father, a medic, had played a very small role in the invasion of French-occupied Lebanon, the action in which Moshe Dayan lost his eye. It is perhaps small wonder that when I left school at the age of 18, with a few months to spare before going to university, I followed in the tracks of an older school friend and went as a volunteer to a kibbutz in Israel. I informed my father of this decision rather than asked his permission, but he was pleased. It was 1969, 2 years after the Six-Day War. I travelled all over. There were surprises as well as shocks. The relationship, in my father's recollection, was much better. The initial mission of his military unit arriving in 1940 was to patrol the Iron Triangle of Nablus, Tulkarm, and Qalqilia. This was the end of the 1936-39 so-called Arab Revolt. The Jewish community was on the side of the British mandatory government. This was the era of the British Jewish special night squads of Ord Wingate, a relative of whom I went to school with later. It was also when the Arab fighter Izzedine El-Qassem was killed, whose name is commemorated as the military wing of Hamas today, as well as the crude rockets fired from Gaza. Since my first visit, other things have changed as well. The kibbutz system, for one, is no longer the socialist experiment in communal living that it was. And young British students are more likely to work with activists protesting the occupation. A few weeks ago, my youngest son won a prize at his school in London. We're living a sort of transatlantic existence at the moment, my family. And a famous former pupil was the star guest. The comments of the actor Alan Rickman, Professor Snape in the Harry Potter movies, were warmly received when he called on the students to be imaginative, brave, unselfish, tolerant, socially and globally responsible. His challenge to them to be Nelson Mandela rather than Rupert Murdoch, I'm sorry, he's the owner of the Times, not Paris Hilton, but rather Rachel Corrie, was met by rapturous applause. But set against the prevailing atmosphere in Britain of being anti-Israel, as well as anti-American, there is now a new British Prime Minister in Gordon Brown who is said to be firmly pro-Israel. This seems extraordinary, given his reputation for not being a conviction politician, as Tony Blair was, but rather an assiduous follower of opinion polls. As Gerard has just explained, Gordon Brown's most recent decision that, having made clear he was bringing back troops, British troops, out of Iraq, he then considered a quick general election, but then shied away from it because the popularity of his Conservative opponent was unexpectedly boosted. Gordon Brown's feelings towards Israel are said to come from his father, a Church of Scotland minister, which is sort of Church of England, sort of Episcopalian, who used to visit Israel twice a year. In a speech to leaders of the British Jewish community earlier this year, Brown said he was a lifelong friend and supporter of Israel. Britain will be a true and constant friend in good times and bad, and we will never compromise our relationship to political expediency. He went on to make references to the hot-button issues concerning his audience, the boycotts of Israel and the Israeli academic community, to which he said he recoiled in revulsion. Today, the 90th anniversary of a British government commitment to Jews, there is no mention of this on the website of the Foreign Office. Indeed, if you search the Foreign Office site, you can find reference to Balfour. He was, after all, a foreign secretary. But searching for the Balfour Declaration produces no hits on the site itself, only a link through to a parliamentary report. The two-sentence biographical note about Balfour on the site reads, "A former prime minister, he cultivated a fine taste for good food, lawn tennis, and philosophy." At the Paris Peace Conference, his behaviour was likened to that of a choir boy at a funeral service. If somebody can explain that to me. The pages on the Foreign Office website about the historical background to the Middle East peace process make a passing reference to the mandate, but not to the background of how Britain was awarded the role by the League of Nations. I should point out that the State Department website is rather clearer on this. On the website of No. 10 Downing Street, the office and home of the British Prime Minister, Balfour fares slightly better. He gets a whole page, and a reference to and quotation from the Balfour Declaration, though the word Jews is misspelt with a lowercase j. But the only photo on the page, apart from a black and white head and shoulders of Balfour himself, is an uncaptioned, completely unexplained colour one of the Mosque of Omar, the Dome of the Rock, that's the one with the golden dome, in Jerusalem. I suspect the problem is that Zionism has become a dirty word in Britain. Some people would argue one can be anti-Zionist without being anti-Semitic. They might even claim that one can be anti-Zionist without being anti-Israel. In reality, Britain has always been uncertain about Zionism. After all, no member of the royal family has ever made an official visit to Israel. There have been bad times and less than bad times, but have there been good times for the relationship? I would suggest that at best it's always been slightly uncomfortable. The era post 9/11 has made this increasingly so. Britain's relationship with Israel is seen as partly explaining the jihadist extremism of some British Muslim youth, along with Britain's closeness to the US in respect to Iraq and Afghanistan. The title of today's occasion is Britain and Zionism, Then and Now. Perhaps the title should have been Britain and Zionism, Ambiguity Then and Ambiguity Now. The ambiguity of the Balfour Declaration in 1917 has been the subject of countless articles and debates. Britain's relationship with Zionism remains so. Thank you.